KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Plotline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
Look, staying healthy isn't easy. Watching your diet, hitting the gym, avoiding stress. But a good night's rest helps boost your overall health and wellness. And it couldn't be easier. The new Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed is the only bed that effortlessly adjusts in response to both of you. The result? You wake up ready for anything. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. And now the new Queen Sleep Number 360 C4 Smart Bed is only $14.99, plus special financing, only for a limited time. Special financing subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. See store for details.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Orchard Nutrition Center, your local neighborhood health food store. We are dedicated to the healthy lifestyle, and we strive for a high standard to carry organic, GMO-free, and clean healthy products.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
We have certified nutritionists on staff that take pride in helping you. Supporting local, we are all in it together. Orchard Nutrition Center, Cypress Square Shopping Center, Reading.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Hey guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filotto, broker and co-owner of the Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and there is no better time to get screened than right now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding roots, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Flatline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Orchard Nutrition Center, your local neighborhood health food store. We are dedicated to the healthy lifestyle, and we strive for a high standard to carry organic, GMO-free, and clean, healthy products.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
We have certified nutritionists on staff that take pride in helping you. Supporting local, we are all in it together. Orchard Nutrition Center, Cypress Square Shopping Center, Reading.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
Everybody, listen up! Hi, I'm Sue Blake with Powerhouse Solar. Solar energy not only makes financial sense, but right now you can go solar for zero money down. And you may qualify to get the 26% federal tax credit. At Powerhouse Solar, we are an elite dealer for SunPower, and we install the most cost-effective and highest efficiency panels. A lot of people don't realize they have options now. You can get the SunPower SunVault battery and solar with financing. So keeping the lights on when the grid goes down is easier than ever. And the entire system is backed by their 25-year warranty. Powerhouse Solar can design a system for your specific needs. Call Powerhouse Solar today at 275-5600 or visit us on the web at powerhousesolar.com. Again, call Powerhouse Solar at 275-5600 or visit us online at powerhousesolar.com.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Redding area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
Journalism allows its readers to witness history. Fiction gives its readers an opportunity to live it. John Hersey.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our episode today is about journalism. This is another common character archetype to have in stories, and joining us today is Julia Avery, a local journalist.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
So tell us about yourself and your work.
I actually just finished at KRCR, the local ABC station in Redding, just last week. I did report at a station before that for a couple of years, so I have about 5 years of experience now in local news.
How did you get into journalism?
It originally started, I wanted to do sports. I realized how difficult that is, especially for a woman. I went into journalism in college to do that, but once I started learning about the impact that news has, I really got passionate about it and took a whole different direction.
Do you have an inspiration that helped you decide that journalism was going to be your future?
I don't have someone when I first started, but I did an internship in college, and there was a photographer. He had gone to Africa when he was younger, and he had covered the whole unrest there. And he told me this story about how they were actually stoning a woman. He would have been likely stoned too if he was caught filming it, so he kept his camera underneath a jacket. And he got some video and took it back and sent it back. And he said the next day, the president was showing the video and talking about it and saying how they're going to go in and try and help. I'll never forget that story because I just thought, wow, this one guy who went out on a limb and risked his life to get some video possibly saved lives and got the attention of America to be able to do something and try and help them. So that's one inspiration I think about all the time.
So especially in today's world, people have a very distinct idea of what it is to be a journalist. They either picture, you know, what you said, the mainstream media and the accusations of bias and whatever. And then you also have the other side where everybody just pictures Ron Burgundy from Anchorman.
Yes.
Are either of those true when it comes to local journalists?
So I would say no. When it comes to local news, I think that's why I love it so much, because it's someone that lives in your community and wants to tell someone's story or uncover an injustice or something, and actually does all the work, usually themselves, when it's in local news, and gets to the bottom of it, then presents it.
So there is a lot of this idea that reporters get their own photog and somebody else edits for them and they can have a helicopter at the snap of their fingers. How much of that has proven true in your own experience?
So really none of it. And when I went into journalism, I thought that that's how it would be. I didn't even know until the first class when they said, you're going to be shooting the video, editing it, tracking it, writing the web story, all of these things. And I just remember being like, just me? No one else is going to do these things? And actually, as you start to get into bigger cities, you get some help. You get a photographer that will follow you around. And if it's a big story, you'll have maybe a van with a satellite truck and things like that. But the local journalists, most of the time, everything that's put out there with their name on it, they did themselves.
So if there's one thing that you could make people understand, what would it be?
I think I'm so passionate about this right now because of the state of everything. But I think it would be that every journalist I've met, and even I don't know the journalists in the mainstream media, but I have friends that know them or my boss knows a lot of them, and they're all genuinely went into this industry to help people. And they tell you in college, if you're here to be on TV, leave because it's never going to work because it's long nights and long hours and a lot of criticism, and you have to actually be passionate about what you're doing for this to be a success for you. We don't want to be destroying unity in people or anything like that because we are part of your community. We don't want to divide people. We don't want to incite fear. And every journalist I've ever met is like that.
Yeah, there's still a lot of good in the journalism world. So if you're writing a journalist character, especially local journalists, remember, they are in it because they're passionate about news and passionate about their communities.
Because let's be real, we're not in it for the pay.
No.
Are there moments you see in fiction, TV, movies, whatever, moments you see reporters and you just want to pull your hair out?
Yes. Last week I was watching this show about first responders. It was very good. And there was a tornado or some sort of natural disaster and people had died. And in the show, all these reporters came up and were filming these people who had died. And everyone's like, stupid reporters, get out of here. And in my mind, I'm thinking, those are local journalists. They're labeled that way. They would never come up and just start shooting dead bodies laying on the street. First of all, they can't air it anyway. Second of all, they're still human beings. They know not to get in your face like that. We typically, especially in local news, tend to stay back, give the family their space. And if we do go up, we try to be very polite and just say, hey, if you want the opportunity to talk, here's my card. If not, I understand type of thing. And so that's what kind of upsets me. So yes, definitely.
From what you've said, journalism is a difficult job.
Mm-hmm.
What about it is, would you say, the most difficult?
Well, it really depends. I mean, if we're talking day-to-day job, it's difficult because you just have so much to get done in one day because a news story that day is news that day. It might not be news the next day. But deep down, if I really thought back at journalism as a whole, I think the hardest part is you sometimes do have to report on things that you know people aren't going to like, but you have to think about how it could be helping the greater population, even if it's just going to upset a few people, which I've struggled with. I've gotten better at, but there are times, you know, I'll have maybe a police officer who's a friend of mine, and maybe they are in an officer-involved shooting. You still have to tell the story. You still have to give it a fair, balanced explanation of what happened, and that's pretty tough.
What kind of lingo is used in journalism that can be used by an author in a story?
So there are quite a few things that over time I have forgotten are actually lingo. For example, if you're out in the field, you say that you're live. If you're out in the field presenting the story that you worked on all day, you say you're live fronting your story. If it's a full story that you had edited and tracked your voiceover and put all the sound bites together, that's a package. I've taught my mom these things over the years, and she's always so proud. She's like, that was a package, right? if you just have a sound bite, it's called a SOT. The most dreaded thing in a reporter's life is called MOS, which I know is man on the street. And it's basically when you have to go out and just ask people on the street what they think about a topic. Reporters hate it. But, yeah, that's called MOS. I think that's the most that's coming to mind right now.
Do you ever start the day thinking this is going to be a story, this is going to be something people want to know about, research it, get those interviews, and then realize there's not actually a story here?
You know, that's actually just recently that happened to me. I had several people giving me tips that their electric bill was triple what it's ever been. My electric bill is triple what it's ever been. And so I thought, this is going to be a huge story. I'm going to get all the numbers. I did all this research. And I finally talked to REU, and they said, well, look at the temperatures. They're way higher than they've been in the last 4 years. And he was even showing me that the days my usage was higher were these days that we were like 110 degrees. And so I'm like, okay, so this isn't a story. It was just hotter. And I actually went to my boss and said, okay, I've done all this work. It's not a story, though, so I'm going to throw all this out. And she's like, no, because you got your answer, but nobody else got their answer. All those people that are concerned still don't know why. And so that was a big learning moment for me because I thought, oh, this isn't a story. But at the end of the day, I did the story, and all those people came back and said, okay, I get it now. I understand.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you would like to add for authors that they need to know about journalists?
I think if I were writing a journalist, I would not want to write them as this type of beauty queen. Because to me, it's like you're out there, you're sweating. Like, I'll bring heels, but usually I'm in shoes that get muddy and I'm running around all day. And then I try to look presentable by the time I'm on camera. But I think a lot of people write their journalists as people who are very professional looking all the time and, you know, poised. And a lot of it, we are in the trenches. I think that's how I think of journalists, but not the general public. So that's something I'd like to add.
So thank you again, Julia, for joining us.
I'd like to end it with, be kind to your local journalists, please.
And write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Metaphors have a way of holding the most truth in the least space. Orson Scott Card.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Today we are talking about the use of similes and metaphors in writing. Before we do that, though, we want to remind you that we are doing a NaNoWriMo giveaway, so if you are participating, head to our website. On the very front page, on the right-hand side, you'll find a link to get more information about how to join us and enter to win copies of our books and some Writing Roots merch.
So similes and metaphors are one of those things that I, as an author and as a human being, have kicked and screamed at and stomped my feet and hated basically my entire life. I am a literalist. Anyone who knows me outside of this podcast can tell you that I will always interpret word for word exactly what you mean before I understand anything outside of that. So if he is a dog, I think he's got ears and a tail.
Translates very literally when we're speaking to Lee. Which is funny because I think you use more metaphors in your writing than I do.
A lot of that is because I'm trying to convey physical movement in a way that makes sense and doesn't come across technical. If he's blocking a punch with both hands, swiping across in like a double windmill kind of thing, that doesn't make nearly as much sense as he swiped both of his hands across his vision like windshield wipers. Okay, you've got a clear image of what that looks like.
So that is one of the uses of similes and metaphors. In one line, you can convey an idea in a shorter amount of time than it would take to explain it literally.
So what is a simile? What is a metaphor?
A simile is a direct comparison. You use like or as. An example of a simile: she dipped a cookie in the coffee like a young boy might dip his toe into a lake before his first swim.
She's doing this like someone would do that. That is the key difference between a simile and a metaphor.
Metaphors will do the comparison as if it were real. So his arms were windshield wipers swiping across his vision, instead of his arms were like windshield wipers swiping across his vision.
And of course, this is the one I struggle with because I'm thinking he now has windshield wipers attached at the elbows. Not literally, but my first image of that moment is this.
And it all depends on your readers. There are very few people out there as literal as Lee. So you're usually good to go with similes, with metaphors, in the right scenarios.
And when you choose to use them, when you choose to apply this particular tool, is very indicative of your writing style. A lot of the authors that I follow, that I enjoy, are very literal. And if Lee Child suddenly started being very flowery in his writing, with lots of similes and metaphors, I would lose my interest in him as an author.
So there are a couple of times when the metaphor is more than just a single line or a single sentence or a single word.
If you are using more than one metaphor in your scene, they should connect in some way. Her blood turned to ice at the sight of the giant. Her blood thawed and then began to boil when the giant stepped on her sister. Maintaining that continuity between metaphors, at least within the same scene, helps understand. If you hop between metaphors, it gets very messy and very difficult to follow what you're doing, and it feels flowery. You're not in that moment.
And then beyond just the scenes, sometimes the entire book can be a metaphor itself. This is most often seen in your literature kind of stories, your novels that were written as a lesson or later on interpreted as a lesson for mankind.
The first time I really recognized this part about myself was when we were assigned to read Metamorphosis by Kafka, where the guy, as a teenager, as I recall, turns into a beetle. It was like a metaphor for puberty and changing into something weird and new. I'm going, no, the kid turned into a beetle. That's what the book said.
This is also very popular, not just in the English lit genre, but in the softer fiction genres, especially Christian, where you have allegories. One really good example of this is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. It's an entire representation of Christian values.
A lot of these types of stories are meant to offer something to the reader, and it's up to the reader to ingest and interpret and therefore participate in the storytelling process, because that's what this means to me. This is a lot more of the artistic writing and less of the entertainment writing. This is also a great tool to relate to your readers in what is an abnormal situation for the characters. So if they're casting a spell, an invisibility spell, I drop it on your head, boop. Okay, we can kind of visually see that because we've seen that in a bunch of TV shows. But the fairy tapped her on the head and then it felt like an egg had been broken and it was gooing through her hair as it dripped down over her entire body. Okay. We have a better idea of the speed, of the temperature, of the goo.
It gives us the sensory details of this moment that would be lost otherwise. Metaphors can also be used as a way to define a character. One of my favorite examples is from Brandon Sanderson's Reckoners series. He has a character who is constantly using similes, calling them metaphors, and they are so bad, but it's purposeful, and it is that character. It is so defining for that character.
If you have a character who is speaking in similes and metaphors, then you need to make sure they're basically the only character who does it. Normal people, and I'm not talking about writers, I'm talking about normal people, rarely speak in similes and metaphors.
And people do use metaphors, but they're common metaphors. Like, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. these are things, we're not literally going to go to a bridge and cross the bridge. We're not literally going to go burn a bridge, but these are common metaphors that we use all of the time. So a lot of what we've been talking about is serious uses for similes and metaphors. Similes and metaphors can be very comedic. Like in the Reckoner series, I'm going to read a quote from it because it's amazing. But even a 90-year-old blind priest would stop and stare at this woman. If he weren't blind, that is. Dumb metaphor, I thought. I'll have to work on that one. I have trouble with metaphors. So it's ridiculous, it's fun, but it's in the right place, and he is the only character that does this, that comes up with the most absurd things. So it's defining for him. It's a fun moment for the reader to connect with a character. Because how many times do we come up with saying something and then realize, well, that was dumb, and then try to move on from it? Another way to use metaphors as comedy is to use malaphors. So I mentioned earlier the you burned that bridge, and we'll cross that bridge when you come to it. You can also say, we'll burn that bridge when we come to it. That's a malaphor. It's a mixing of metaphors in a comedic way.
And of course, if you have your laptop in front of you and are just looking for a giggle, looking up metaphors by high school students can be hilarious.
The little boat gently drifted across the pond exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't.
Murphy fell 12 stories, hitting the pavement like a hefty bag filled with vegetable soup.
It's so visual. And maybe appropriate in the right setting, but man, in the wrong setting with the wrong timing, that is a terrible metaphor.
I love it. So learning similes and metaphors is something you have to kind of learn about your own writing style. This is something you'll start to notice as you read more in your genre, what works and what doesn't, and what you like and what you don't like. Is it adding to the scene, or is it just redefining the scene? If you're just redefining, you're wasting time, because it can distract, but it can also add so much. Those undefinable moments, those emotions that we don't have words for, similes and metaphors are great for drawing your reader into that emotion.
That's the goal of any writer. Get the readers emotionally invested in your story, connected. And if everything is super literal, it's hard to get that emotional connection. Or it just takes forever because you're spending so much time trying to explain one motion, one movement, one feeling. You don't want to have that distance. And so consider using similes and metaphors, but make sure it's right for your genre. Make sure it's right for you. And if you're like Lee and you don't think in similes and metaphors, go ahead and stick with being literal. That's fine, because what you should be doing is
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. 1 Samuel chapter 17.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Essis. And today we are talking about basically just people, but magically bigger people.
That would be the giants. Now, we're not talking about Andre the Giant giants, not people who are just incredibly tall. We are talking about actual mythical creatures, legends, tales of races of tall people.
Across the world, a lot of cultures show tall people as powerful people. I believe there are two different Shinto emperors who are reported to have been more than 10 feet tall. These huge giant people, literally very tall, make them very powerful to see. So at first sight, if your hero is encountering a giant, they can be very intimidated without even talking to or encountering physically.
So when we're talking about these mythical giants, the biggest thing about them in most legends is that they're basically people, but big. They are sometimes slower, less intelligent, but always strong.
And I've found across my different studies of giants around the world, cannibalism is something that we see a lot of, or at least eating humans in some way. You know, grind your bones for bread kind of a mantra. We see that in a couple of different giant stories around the world.
I have a hard time siding with Jack on the Jack and the Beanstalk story. What would you do if somebody invaded your house and stole your stuff?
Probably exactly the same thing.
Maybe not eat them, but, you know.
At least smush them.
Yes. So let's get into some examples of giant or large, intimidating, strong creatures. Of course, you have your trolls and your ogres and your orcs.
And the Urukai, which are important.
Urukai!
A lot of the references to giants are an alternate race, similar to elves and dwarves, where they are human-like, but not. They aren't exactly gods. They aren't demonic in any way. They're mostly just a different kind of people.
In Norse mythology, you have the Jotuns.
And to be clear, the Avengers mythology as well.
Of course, the frost giants from Jotunheim are very based on this race of giants in Norse mythology.
There was a carving that was dated to about the 10th century AD of, I'm not going to try to pronounce her name because I'm going to butcher it, but one of the Jotun riding a dog like a horse, might have been a wolf, and she had like reins on it, but the reins were made of snakes. It was a very interesting depiction of, because most of the time when we see giants, we don't see them using tools in that kind of a sophisticated way. It's mostly like a club and smash Harry Potter in the bathroom.
If you want to look that up, I believe the pronunciation is Hyrokin. It's Hyrrokkin.
And of course, heading south to the Middle East, the Judeo-Christian history, we have the Philistines, which our opener was referencing, these gigantic warrior-type people.
Even if you aren't super familiar with the Judeo-Christian beliefs, you likely have heard the term Goliath. You've heard that and know that it references a giant, a huge human that is not easily defeated. So if we want to go down under to Australia, there is an oral tradition of a giant known as Crooked Mick.
If you're listening from the U.S., you probably know who Paul Bunyan is. Crooked Mick is like Paul Bunyan, but cooler. Not only does he like chop down stuff and shear sheep and such, but he makes great pies, apparently.
Not only are his pies good, but they are light, so light that a gust of wind can carry them away. And not only are pies getting carried away, if he kicks a crocodile, he can send it to the moon. Sorry, I'm having a really hard time keeping a straight face during this. I love this, and it's just so much fun. that you've just got this, like, Australian bushman that's going out there kicking crocodiles and baking pies.
And generally doing everything that, you know, humans do, but way cooler. So you want to look that one up? That's Crooked Mick. And that's more legend than, like, people believed he actually existed. I mean, obviously, spurned from somewhere.
Again, much like Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have a giant that is super familiar because of its prominence in Greek and Roman tradition, and that's the Cyclops.
He's also familiar because he's the dude with one eye. Which is interesting because most of the depictions I see of the Cyclops, he has the holes in the face in a normal where humans would have eyes, but they're just sort of skinned over, and then he has a third eye at the top of the center of the forehead. I always thought that was weird. It wasn't like they were, like, merged, you know?
I'm just picturing the Cyclops and Hercules, the Disney animated version, where it's just, like, one big eye that's, like, half his face in the middle of his forehead. He has a very tall forehead as a result.
Most of the ones we've talked about so far are enemies of humans in some way. They're hunting them, they're smashing rocks and trying to kill the normal everyman.
Except for Crooked Mick, he's saving them from the crocodiles.
Okay, that's fair. I am talking about the Gentile, I believe it's pronounced. These are a race of giants found in the northern parts of Spain, close to where it meets France, in that little bay there. They existed, and they basically just hung out with the humans, and they were really known for their ability to throw rocks. And that's how a bunch of little islands off the coast were formed. But they were said to have lived alongside the Basque people at one point.
They were also said to have invented metallurgy, the saw, and grew the first wheat, and then taught the humans how to farm.
Most of them disappeared when the comet flew across the sky around the same time that Christ was born. That was sort of a harbinger for them to go, okay, it's bedtime, and they basically just went and lived under a mountain.
There was one that was said to have remained, known as Olentzero, O-L-E-N-T-Z-E-R-O, and he's said to appear at Christmas and is reproduced as a straw doll.
And of a lot of the giants we find, these ones are furry, they're hairier. Until we get into more modern mythology and cryptozoology.
Fun cryptozoology. If we want to go a little coastal islander, in Fijian mythology, there is a giant who is so large that his teeth looked like they were burning logs. And that is why his name is Flaming Teeth.
Very original. So he basically tortured the humans in the village for so long that a bunch of warriors went, lured him under a big rock, and then pushed it over on him. He died, and his teeth were brought back to the village, which brought fire to the humans.
Fascinating.
We all have some sort of this is how humans got fire story, I think.
And it's never, hey, we boofed two rocks together and went, ooh, look, fire. And then if we go to Eastern Asian cultures and mythologies, the Hindu and Buddhist cultures have the Rakshasas, and they were depicted as shape-shifting, fierce-looking, enormous creatures with two fangs that protruded from the top of their mouth.
They have a lot of similarities between them and the modern Bram Stoker version of Dracula, of a lot of the vampire mythology. Oh. The shape-shifting, the eating people, especially their blood, needing to be invited into a building. These are all Rakshasa tropes that also appear with vampires, which we'll talk about in three episodes.
Yes.
These ones are a little strange because I didn't necessarily want to put shapeshifters in with giants because giants are naturally large creatures, and these ones can appear humanoid. But they are described as giant, larger than, scarier than humans, and with a lot more magical abilities than most giants we're going to see. And again, eating people is a thing.
So let's look into the literature and references to giants in fiction as we know it today in modern ages.
Of course, from Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, we have the Brobdingnag, which is a giant, and opposite the Lilliputians, which are the tiny people we talked about a couple episodes ago.
And Gulliver is like the normal-sized person in the middle?
Yep.
Okay. It has been a very long time since I've watched a movie that relates to that, and I've never read the book.
Yeah, it's been a while since I read the book. I didn't really follow most of it. I think I was a little too young for that. But if you're younger and you're looking for it, Roald Dahl has the BFG.
Big Friendly Giant. One of my favorites is actually Fezzik from The Princess Bride, portrayed by Andre the Giant. Absolutely love him. So great. And then the classic example, the Cyclops from Odyssey.
And the last one I just want to touch on, because I think this is how most people are familiar with giants and trolls and half-giants and such, is Harry Potter. We see trolls in the first book, and then one of the closest friends of the main characters is half-giant. They make fun of giant-type people a couple of different times. You know, just point and grunt. It's not that hard to talk their language.
Yeah, and in Harry Potter, the half-giants are especially considered, looked down on as lesser beings because of their mixed race.
So if I'm being plagued by a giant, how do I take it down?
Just make them fall over.
Okay. Crushing under their own weight. We see this a couple of different ways. We see that, of course, in Mickey Mouse had some of that. And I think the most classic version is Jack and the Beanstalk.
When he makes the giant fall off the beanstalk, chops it down while the giant's climbing down. Again, Jack invaded his house. What else was he supposed to do?
She's not going to let this die.
I'm not. Another thing when it comes to giants is the eyes tend to be vulnerable, especially with your cyclopses. The eyes and the face in general.
And I believe that's how the hero actually defeated the Cyclops, was he drove a spear or a lance into the Cyclops' eye. And then the Cyclops ran around going, "Nobody stabbed me in the eye," because he had convinced the Cyclops that his name was Nobody.
And in general, you deal with a giant the same way you would deal with a human. They're stronger, they're bigger, but they have the same kind of vulnerabilities. Their anatomy is generally the same. But they may be a little bit more invulnerable to magic.
Of course, you could go with the Princess Bride logic and the Fijian logic.
The moment his head is in view, hit it with a rock!
Seemed to work for them. They have fire. And in general, most of the time you're going to see your heroes be smarter and more agile than your giants. This goes back to your David and Goliath story of, okay, I have a power behind me that you can't take down, so I'm smarter, I'm faster, I'm going to whack you in the head with a rock. Even though I am smaller, I can still beat you.
D&D stats, they have better dexterity.
Yep.
I hope this information has helped you, given a few ideas about introducing a giant character or giant race into your stories. You can play with it. You can have fun with it. Remember, these are mythologies. These are malleable creatures that you can use and play with and do as you will.
And these are an easy one, I think, to slip in, because it's not like the Chimera, which we'll talk about next episode, where you have to describe this element and that element, and they're going to shoot fireballs and whatever at you because of the specifics of this particular monster. Basically, everyone in your audience goes, "Giant, right, I have an image of that in my head. I don't need a 3-page description in order to follow the plot."
So go out, create, have fun, put giants into your story, and always
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writinggroups@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Magic happens between the notes. Linda Bott.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And joining us today is Linda Bott. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, guys. So we wanted to give you, our listeners, an idea of what it's like to be on stage, to be performing in front of a bunch of different people. So I dragged Linda Bott in because she's done this since you were a kid, right?
Yes. I professionally started working at 15.
Wow.
So I could say that's when I first started getting paid. But I have been singing, you know, basically growing up in the country where you've got horses and trees and the creativity of what it is to have imaginary friends and audiences. And, you know, I was the most famous person living in the country.
Yeah. Wow.
So, tell us about how you got your start. What exactly is it that you do?
I was basically just naturally, I think, gifted in the fact that I have a good ear and that my parents belong to Capitol Records. And one of the albums was Barbra Streisand. My brother to this day can't stand listening to anything Barbra Streisand because I emulated every single intonation and tone and breath. And so she basically was my voice teacher. And I learned how to hold my breath and have these big tones. And so that's what I do, is I sing. And then down the road, you know, that meant jingles, that meant recording, that meant, okay, you want to be in this show, you have to learn these lines. Okay, can you dance? So I kind of did the acting, singing, and dancing, and did some stage plays and was in a couple theatrical productions in high school and doing stuff like that.
I think the first time I met you was on the local stage here. I was working behind the scenes and helping get set pieces up and on. And it was a Christmas show.
Are you talking Martinis with Santa?
Yes.
I wrote that show.
Nice.
And produced that show. So that was a really big undertaking for me because I had written a song with one of my Nashville buddies named Cam King, and we wrote the song Martinis with Santa. And I thought, okay, now what am I going to do with this song? I recorded it a few times in different albums that I have produced and actually released. Besides trying to fill the seats, making sure the seats were filled, it was just a glorious experience.
So you are a stage performer, you are a singer. A lot of people have a very specific image in mind when they think of someone who's a performing artist. They think about actors, actresses, the glamour, the flashing cameras. They think about Broadway and all of the
jazz hands?
Jazz hands.
Literal jazz hands.
I don't know. So that's interesting because I think we all see the world through our own personal lens. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, first of all, it's a craft. There's a lot of grunt work involved in what it is. People just think you just roll out of bed and you have no idea the grunt work that goes into performing and what it is to, it's a lot of energy to put on high heels and put on clothes. And when you're hungry, you'll take any job. I used to say to my agent, just give me the Ramada Inn, I'll take a piano bar for $30. And that's the truth.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.